welcome to Two Crickets in a Thorn Tree.
Hello, everyone.
It's Gabriel and Nick.
How's it?
Long Boy and Lure Liberty.
Yep, yep.
It's Ballantine's Day.
Yes.
So we got a bottle of Hanky Ballantine's finest alcohol whiskey.
Cheers.
And here we are at the tail end of a very long week.
Indeed. A week which I was struck down by some terrible flu. Not quite COVID-2019, which is the fun new name for the coronavirus.
Nouveau SARS.
But it was rather unpleasant.
Yeah, you were out, and so that left me to deal with a lot of people coming to the office saying, hey, where's Nick? And then you came back, and you were stuck in meetings all day, and people kept saying, hey, where's Nick?
So that's good to be missed.
It's great for my self-esteem. Mm. No one has ever come in to be like, oh, hey, Gabe. But that's okay. You're a friendlier guy. You're also much more of a pessimist. I don't know if they go together.
I know. I've just felt very pessimistic recently, and there's been very little to change my mind.
Yeah. No, data points are not rolling to prove you wrong.
The sort of South Africa is looking just like so bleak, although that was the subject of our last one. So let's not get too bogged down on that.
Yeah, okay. So I want to say one good news thing, and I said to listeners of the Daily Friend sort of three times a week podcast that I would address this here on this august forum of the Thorn Tree. And it's a question that I think South Africans really do well to ask themselves. And anyone thinking about South Africa does well to ask themselves, because it's quite big, sort of almost abstract, but embodies itself in one particular person. The question is Nelson Mandela the Hindenburg of South Africa?
So who is Hindenburg?
Well, Hindenburg's a big zeppelin that got set on fire.
No, not that one. The other one. The other one that was big, but not as big.
So that Hindenburg was named after
Paul von Hindenburg.
He had many names, von this, von that, von the other thing.
He was a war hero in the First World War.
Yeah.
But so, also had been in the German army since forever.
He had been in the German army when they were crushing the French, I feel, back in the 1870s, and was a retired general. World War I comes along, things are chugging along marvelously until people realize that the war's not going to be over by Christmas.
And there's a lot of Russians coming.
Russia has the largest infantry the world has ever seen. Russia's really good for a few things. Poetry, very depressing novels, vodka, and blood.
Lots and lots of soldiers.
Russia gave a lot of blood, and the Germans were getting worried that they'd be overwhelmed. So they called back Herr Meister.
Paul von Hindenburg.
Yeah, and he came with his old series about honor and tactics and overwhelming the enemy with manliness.
And the Russians helped him out at a place called Tannenberg by being very useless.
You know, this is and I mean, okay, so one early parallel, I suppose, is that the largest statue in Germany was of Hindenburg. was of Hindenburg, and the idea was that if you wanted to support the German war effort, you could buy a nail to go into the statue that would be erected in one of the plazas of him and be a big, marvelous thing. But instead of paying like the cost of a nail, you pay, like in today's terms, like R1,000, and all the extra money goes to paying for the war effort. So it was kind of like war bonds, but sort of just war donations. Mm. You know, donate to the grand hero.
A symbolic thing, yeah.
Yeah. And it raised a lot of money, and it made a big, beautiful statue. And then him and Ludendorff and Groener and the rest did really, really well at setting up a defensive line and then driving the Russians back on the eastern front of Germany. Mm. And then they pivoted to the west.
Well, they did pretty well too. In fact, I think Hindenburg ends the war as one of the supreme commanders of the German army.
Yeah, so he rises to the tip-top. And he really is a grand hero. And he really was a man of moral courage. He was a man of physical courage. He was a man of honor. I think that it's quite hard to fault him. He made personal sacrifices. He was a champion of the German national cause. It's a little bit complicated because World War I is so easy to look back on as a pointless war, where there's no real victor. In fact, it's a war that doesn't end. I take Niall Ferguson's line seriously that you really should think of World War I and World War II as being the same war. Something, with an interregnum, an armistice.
Victor Davis Hanson agrees with that as well.
Yeah. These are both American-based historians that Nick and I kind of fan on a bit, critically. Anyway, so great guy. And the Germany that emerges from 1918, 1919 is much like South Africa coming out of 1994. What do I mean by that? I think one of the really underrated qualities of World War I was the sense of it being a race-based war. Today we think of race as just being black and white. But back in the day, if you said Anglo-Saxon, that's a race, they said, of course it's a race. If you said Slav, that's a race, they said, of course that's a race. Gael, Teuton.
When nationalism was, in a sense, a kind of racism of a sort.
Yeah. And then people really thought of themselves as sharing ancestry and that being the real unit of selection. And we've discussed a little bit before Dominic Lievin, the Don of History at Cambridge, his theory that World War I is really created by race nationalists, Slav race nationalists in particular, in Russia, in South Slavia, what we then come to call Yugoslavia. Yugo is just the word for South in the Slavonic languages. So it's like South Africa. Anyway, and their idea, the Slavic idea is that we need a, you know, one nation to hold all the Slavs together and then we'll really win. And that really matters because they see the retreat of the Ottoman Empire, so they've got a decolonizing flag to wave. They say the Mongol yoke held Moscow, Kiev under its pressure, and then we managed to lift the yoke.
Huh? Its hooves, I suppose.
Yeah, under its hooves, the Mongol hooves. And we managed to undo that, but the Ottoman yoke continues to oppress the South Slavians, and we as Pan-Slavians need to get our act together and take over those lands around the Hellespont. Also, it's going to be strategically good because it gives Russia access to the Mediterranean Sea. And that becomes their sort of policy focus. Diplomats, military experts, generals in Russia who are against that and are more pragmatists and say, look, we've got these people to the Far East who might look different to us, so they don't qualify as Slavs as being part of the same race. They've got yellower skin. They've got a different look in the eye. But they're Russians. They speak Russian, and we need to develop infrastructure there. We need to sort of develop the economy there, develop trade there. They were just hounded out as basically white monopoly capitalists of the time. They were called German bourgeois decadent promulgators of self-interest. Okay, so that was like a disaster, and it meant that the Russian war drum kept being banged to the point where where some like archduke is assassinated in South Slavia by a South Slav, Pan-Slav nationalist, Gavrilo Princip. The Germans are like, dude, we don't trust the Russians not to turn this into some kind of race war.
And, the Russian,
and so we have to respond to this.
Yeah, and the Russian general staff are worried about the sort of overall rise of Russian power, which they think will even inevitably overwhelm Germany, and so that the Germans have to act sooner rather than later to stop this behemoth, this dangerous animal.
Because once you're into race like competition, then you also like, well, which race is breeding faster, which race is bigger, which race is developing faster? Oh, if you give them the chance, the one with the most numbers, they're going to just crush us all, so they gear up against it. Okay, so this is just background to say like that.
This is the context from which Paul von Hindenburg arises, the war.
Yeah.
He doesn't win, but he's seen as a hero in by the Germans.
This sort of confusing race war. And although the Germans didn't set it up that way, this really becomes the German way of thinking about it afterwards. What's the first big mistake that Hindenburg makes? It is Kaiser Wilhelm II was the supreme commander of Germany.
Its emperor
going into the war. And by 1970, and he was bellicose, hey? That oak just wanted to blick some people.
The slur, here's an interesting aside, the slur against Germans in the First World War that was popular, the Huns, they used to call Germans Huns, actually came from a Kaiser Wilhelm speech when he was speaking to German troops about to be sent off to Namibia. To kill Namibians, basically, to commit them.
Do a little genocide.
Genocide.
Yeah.
He said, you must be as the Huns were to Europe or something like that. You must be destroy everything in your wake and leave nothing alive. Mm-hmm. And a journalist who was supposed to be kept out of the event was standing on a rooftop nearby and heard the speech, which was sort of off script.
Yeah.
And so this is the kind of guy Kaiser Wilhelm was.
Yeah, the ad lib. And of course, that really suits the Slav race nationalist idea because they were taken over by the Huns coming from the east. And now the Huns are coming from the west. All enemies to the Slav. Okay, so Hindenburg, okay, so Kaiser Wilhelm II, this bellicose emperor, needs to step aside before a reasonable peace treaty can be agreed upon. This becomes
And the whole of Germany is collapsing as well at this time.
Internal strife is crazy. Someone needs to give him the message from the military to say, you know, we don't want to do like the Russians and
the German army is. I think they at the end there they said to him, the army is basically finished.
You've got to step down. So the first message is you've got to step down. It's up to Hindenburg to give the message. Hindenburg is ready to give the message until the very last moment. Then he can't do it because he says, as a man of honor, I am sworn to allegiance to Sir Kaiser and I can't tell him. So he asks his friend Ludendorff or Gröner, won't you please just let him know that he should step down? So he delegates that hard task. Then Germany gets its new Weimar Republic, a government declared by means of shouting out of a window on the Wilhelmstrasse, we are the government. It's a great way to start a government.
We should try that.
Yeah. The Institute of Race Relations has seriously been considering which window we're going to go for if things get worse. Okay, they get the charge, and it's time for them to, after the armistice of 11th November, at 11 past 11, they say, okay, no more fighting. It's time to go to Versailles and cut a deal. And the deal being offered by the Allies is pretty brutal. Maybe not brutal enough, maybe too brutal. That's not a debate for now. Victor Davis Hanson has very interesting views on that. And Nicholas is looking at me with
menace
in his eyes. But it's a hard deal for Germans to swallow. I think that we can agree on.
It wounds their pride for sure.
Yeah. They've got to take sole responsibility for the war, which they've got good grievance about, especially if Dominic Levin's theory about the pan-Slavic race nationalist project sort of making it very difficult for them to avoid some kind of response is correct. And so the new government, having declared itself out the window, now finds himself in the awkward position of sitting in Versailles and being like, what do we do? So they call the generals and they're like, guys, this is not looking good. You know, if we have to – this is a stinky pill that we have to swallow. Is there any way out of it? If we take up the war again, can we knock those guys back? And the answer comes back, we couldn't last 2 weeks. If they come after us properly, the Americans come back at it. We couldn't last 2 weeks. And that's not even that's even if they come at us with half force. We're just so at the end of our tether, the supply lines, the logistics, defection rates, morale, everything is not looking good. So you kind of got to take whatever deal they have to offer. This is the assessment of the hardcore sort of military intelligence here. At the top, they say to Hindenburg, he challenges them, they answer all of his questions, and he's like, you're right. You are correct. There's nothing we can do. So he picks up the phone to call Versailles and say, guys, you've got to take whatever you can get. But he puts it down. He says, as a man of honor, I just cannot bring myself. This is like kneeling down before the French. Oh, my God, the French. And the English and those American upstarts with their –
those shopkeeping Americans.
Those merchants with no honor at all. Now I must bow down before them and take whatever I can get. Impossible. I just won't do it. But, of course, the military factors he can't fight either. So what does he do? Well, he says to Ludendorff or Gröner, I think it's Gröner, don't you want to make the call instead? So he delegates the second task, and Gröner makes the call. Why does this matter? Well, it matters because in the 20s, a myth begins to take root that the Germans could have won the war, but they were cheated at the negotiating table.
And stabbed in the back by the Jews.
Yes.
Amongst others.
It all goes together. This myth that the Germans could have won the war but were cheated at the negotiating table becomes not only important at a sort of rhetorical level on the public square, the soapboxes where new race nationalists are rising up to harness the grief in a hyperinflationary economic catastrophe and say, well, if your lives are miserable, come to me, for I am the prophet of salvation. And believe me when I say that if we just band together according to blood, then pragmatism and economic growth and all that other stuff will.
Says a Mr. Adolf Hitler.
Yeah. But he's far from the only one, eh? In the 20s, he's just one of thousands upon thousands upon thousands of new dudes. One of Adolf Hitler's probably his most important initial realpolitik victories is to get the military rear guard on side. This is important because Germany had a huge army, millions and millions of people, and the Treaty of Versailles said you're no longer allowed to have a huge army. So all of a sudden, you've got 4 million at least unemployed soldiers who know discipline, who know how to use guns, who know how to organize, who know how to take commands, who know how to delegate. They are potent, and they are looking
for the Freikorps call.
They're looking for something. And eventually they become the brown shirts when the Nazis really get hold of them, and then he does a bit of a purge, and then you get the black shirts. And the key strategic sort of connection that he makes with them before the anti-Semitism thing, because they were so not preoccupied with that. It's important to remember, as Niall Ferguson likes to point out, that Germany had the highest rate of interracial marriage. Race, of course, Semite was a race, but interracial marriages between Semitic
Germans
peoples,
and
Germans and Jews, in Europe at the time. If you look at where W.H. Auden and Isherwood and sort of the great poets of the era, they were all hanging out in Berlin because it had the most cosmopolitan culture. It really did take over Vienna as the cosmopolitan capital of Middle Europe. It was a great place to be gay. It was a great place to make theater, to make extravagant paintings that sort of pushed the boundaries of what's acceptable in a revered art space. And if you look at the propaganda that comes out in the 30s against the Jews, so much of it was the cosmopolitan Jew, some guy wearing a suit, smoking a cigarette with a beautiful woman on his arm, she's bejeweled, and he is rich and famous because he is a real harnesser of cultural mores. He's a movie maker. He's a theater writer. He is a painter. He's a poet. He's a philosopher. The reason that stereotype worked was because in Germany in the 20s, there were a lot of really successful Jews, really popular Jews, really famous Jews.
Driving culture.
Who were driving culture, right? So you mustn't think that Germany came from – and there is a powerful and really disturbing analogy to the Johannesburg that I've lived in for the last several years, which has had so much beautiful creativity, so much tolerance, so much extravagance. And in its more elite spaces – much like in the heartlands, once you sort of get outside the media echo chamber of kind of boring news and into the creative space, the music industry, the film industry, the arts industry, it's everything is a rainbow. Everything is fabulous, right? So that's not a guardian against the doom. That can become just another data point to be used in propaganda that brings the doom about. And the key linchpin for the Nazis to beat out the other soapbox rubbishes was to say, and you know what matters the most? The Treaty of Versailles. That was the first plank, and that was the thing that Hitler hit hardest. We were robbed at the negotiating table. We could have won the war. I was a soldier. I knew that we were prouder and braver and truer and more resilient than the enemy, and we could have beaten them, but we were cheated at the negotiating table by a bunch of social liberal Democrats.
And communists.
And communists and Jews and these soft-hearted, weak-minded, namby-pamby. If he had the word soy boy in his vocabulary, he would have said it. That's what the enemy was. And they cheated us at the negotiating table. So what we need to do is re-harness the same energy, get rid of the corrupt elements at the head of the snake that redirected it the wrong way, get the same musculature going, but this time use the battering ram to bash away our neighbors and establish ourselves as a potent force. And that, of course, was music to the ears of all of these disgruntled soldiers who had nothing to do excepting sit on their hands.
Now they had someone to beat up.
So they could go beat up all of the people that Hitler said were enemies inside the country and then go beat up all the people that Hitler said were enemies outside of the country. So I'm trying to say
– and at the end of the day, of course, the result is Germany destroyed, everything bombed, half the country occupied by communists.
Yeah. Really, really bad outcome for Hitler.
But what does this mean for us?
So, what was – I want to take it slightly slowly and just say it's important to remember that in the 20s, Hitler was nothing. Hindenburg, when he first hears about Hitler, says, that little Austrian corporal, who does he think he is? because Hitler didn't even come from Germany because he was never much of anything in the military.
He was a homeless man, and you know, he had served bravely, but like in a very minor role. He was a very low rank. He was a corporal.
So Hindenburg really thought he had him. That's one important thing. In a really big way, he did nearly have him, because Hindenburg was in a time when Germans couldn't agree on anything. Dude, they could not agree on anything in the 20s and 30s. Everything was going wrong, right? So there were socialists, there were communists. Within the communists, there were Trotskyists, internationalist communists. There were sort of more do it at home first, Rosa Luxemburg style communists. On the other side of things, there were sort of capitalists that were very into the free market. There were oligopolists who were very into protected markets, tariffs against Russia. Previously, they'd been quite pro-free trade. That stopped.
National socialist fascist types.
God, there was everything. And if you look at its parliament was the Reichstag was formed and dissolved. It was a catastrophe. There were many, many elections because no one could get a majority. No one could get a working coalition. The guys trying to hold the center were ridiculed for being inept, useless, unable to implement anything kind of guys. Their ideas are maybe bad, maybe good, but they can't even do it. The one thing everyone agreed on in this time was that Hindenburg was a hero. And that is the great analogy between Hindenburg and Nelson Mandela. South Africa is really sitting in a situation where in a lot of ways, the people who have big platforms really can't agree. Should we nationalize all the land? Should we privatize all the land?
Nationalize some of the land?
Should we nationalize some of the land? Should we do like a blended finance scheme?
Should we adopt BEE or reject BEE? Should we, you know?
It's just endless like points of disagreement. The ANC is the most popular party, but it's like half of South Africans aren't voting, so it's only a quarter of South Africans that are really voting for the ANC.
Can't agree on what to do.
Within the ANC, there are at least two factions that are at each other's necks. It's a mess. We're not a coherent society at the level of public discourse. Even if, as the Institute keeps saying, you know, at our core values, there's like 80% of South Africans that are good people. Okay. But so at the level of public discourse, we can't agree about anything excepting this, surely, that Nelson Mandela was a great guy. And that's the simplest analogy between him and Hindenburg. And the greatest part of the analogy is that they were both heroes in a time when countries really needed a hero. And cursed are the times when you really need a hero. The problem is that Hindenburg's heroism depended on a simple thought that he could have won the war, but that he was cheated at the negotiating table. And he himself proactively allowed that thought to grow from the very top by delegating the responsibility of telling Wilhelm that he needs to abdicate, by delegating the responsibility to tell the new Weimar Republic that it needs to take any deal it can get because they're going to be crushed. And then after that, by delegating the responsibility of standing up and saying, guys, we could not have won the war. We had to do this. We have to make this negotiation work. We have to figure out how to make this work. We can't try and wish that it could be undone.
And how does his story end?
God, it ends really badly. Adolf Hitler starts rising to power. He thinks he can command him. He thinks he can control him. He thinks he can manipulate him. He thinks
they go into coalition together. Don't
then
they?
He thinks I need to use this guy to shore up his report in order to batter off the ultra left communists. But and then once I've done that, then I can turn against him. That doesn't work. He goes senile. His son kind of steps into his place, endorses Hitler. Posthumously, there's this crazy thing where Wilhelm's last letter is to Hitler saying, if you're reading this letter, it's because I'm dead now and you need to bugger off, you vicious little thing. And if you have any sense of honor and if you've meant any of the stuff that you said all your life about how you respect me, then you're going to take my word at this. That letter is crushed and hidden. And instead, Hindenburg's son stands up and says, well, you know, Hitler's a jolly good chap and he's going to get the shit together. And this is just like unnervingly similar to what went on with Mandela and the growing race nationalists and communists in South Africa, especially Malema. Mandela never slammed Malema. He surely would have thought of him as a little corporal, some guy who during the great...
He's a young lion. He'll mellow with time.
The People's War. Or he was a nothing. He's like a nine-year-old passing around from messages. Yes,
from Limpopo, no one cares.
I'm saying during the struggle, yeah. Malema was a kid. He wants to claim struggle credentials. But whereas Nelson Mandela was the head of the army, right? The resistance army. But the really crucial thing is that the idea that begins to nestle in South Africans' hearts and minds around the time that Jacob Zuma comes to take over in 2007, 2008, I experienced this when I go to University of Cape Town in 2008, is that we were cheated at the negotiating table. Mandela was a good guy. He bargained for what he thought he could bargain for, but we had an amazing struggle army, and they could have wiped out the Nats, and we could have had everything, and instead of only got some of the things. And so that's the right that we need to wrong. And he allowed that message to fester during his reign. He spoke up the National Democratic Revolution. He spoke up the thought that were it not for the third force, there wouldn't have been any violence. Whereas, like, the empirical, you know, the Goldstone Commission, Dr. Antia Jeffries' thorough analysis.
A people's war, if you will.
It was a people's war, and it really was primarily between the ANC and the Inkatha Freedom Party. And there's no ways that the ANC could have taken out the Nats. Not because they weren't braver, not because they didn't have justice on their side, but because wars aren't decided by who's got the right idea. They're decided by who's got the guns and who's got the money.
And the better strategy and the more gear and all that.
And the Nats had the better strategy, and they had the guns, and they had the tanks, and they had the Caspers, and they had all of that stuff. And the ANC's army was, like, you know, has widely been rated by real experts as the very least
dangerous one in the whole of Africa,
yeah,
of all the liberation armies.
So I think that this is all to say that part of the reason we love Nelson Mandela and that we all agree he's a great guy is because he was a humanist who saw through race and who saw through the superficial bullshit to true humanity and forged forgiveness and stood up for liberalism, stood up for freedom, stood up for a rules-bound system. And that's great. But part of the reason that people love Mandela, and I felt this at high school, a high school we both went to,
yeah,
dudes there – There were black race nationalists there who were both black and white, eh? Wokies before the term was hugely into the fact that Nelson Mandela was a struggle hero. He was an army guy, and he could have destroyed the whites.
Yes.
Were it not for the fact that he went soft too soon.
No, I think
they love that militarism, that schoolboy militarism. That's a huge reason that he's loved. That's why he's loved by Malema. That's why he's loved by
someone in
Winnie Madikizela followers.
Either someone in late primary school or early high school said to me, the thing that's great about Mandela is that he could have taken revenge but didn't.
Yeah. And it's an incorrect assessment. It's a fundamentally incorrect assessment. The ANC got better than the best bargaining position that anyone could have hoped for. They got it too well. If we'd had a more federalized system, it would have been harder, I think, for them to hold on to power for so long in so many parts of the country. And that greater competition would have kept the party more honest and more healthy, I think. Mm. So in fact, they kind of won too much, I think, for their own good.
Yes.
For our own good, I say, as a childhood lover of the ANC, you know, that's what I was brought up in.
I've never had this problem.
was a ululation and a celebration of them. I maintain that that they're the greatest party this country's ever had, and at this stage they're the worst party around today. I mean, in terms of damage that they've done in the last 10 years, like, obviously they're the guys in charge, so maybe it's a false standard. But anyway, so the thought is that Hindenburg held on to his esteem, and we talk about the esteem economy a lot.
Yeah.
He was the most esteemed person in Germany.
He was more interested in protecting his heroic image than he was in saving the country from its own ridiculous lies.
Yeah, and I think that if the reason to talk about this is that it's 30 years since Nelson Mandela was released by F.W. de Klerk. That was a commemoration that we had on Tuesday, and it's an important day. And Nelson Mandela came out immediately and said, we have to keep up the armed struggle. There was a problem in that speech. I think he could have avoided saying that. That's Antia Jeffries' turning moment. In her book, The People's War, which is, in my opinion, the best book to have come out in the country last year, she says he really didn't have to say that. That's her estimation. Yeah. I think historians can disagree about that reasonably. But certainly what came after, particularly what came after his presidency in 1999, the fact that he didn't speak out and say, guys, we need to embrace this compromise that we've made around a liberal constitution because it's the best thing we could have hoped for. It's not like we were cheated at the bargaining table.
Our army was
not in a winning position. You need to make this work and stop hankering after some missed opportunity to spill blood.
The other thing
to cleanse the sins of apartheid, because it was never a good idea and it was never a practical idea and it's never something we could have done.
The other thing you probably should have said something about was HIV/AIDS denialism.
I think he did do something by promoting Nkosi Johnson.
Yes.
I think
he did it.
That was his way of doing it, through persons.
He did it, but sort of not directly. Like, he didn't attack it directly, which created a space, I think, for people to believe two things about the ANC at the same time, which is what the ANC is very good at.
But the particular one in this instance, I hear you on that. The particular one on this is that on Tuesday, almost no one in the country said, well done, F.W. de Klerk. This is 30 years after you made the bold decision to turn against the race nationalists in your own party.
It seems like an easy thing to do because, you know,
it was so hard at the time.
But it was difficult for him.
There were so many people saying, you can't do this, you can't trust them. There were so many people saying, if you do this, much like with Ramaphosa today, there were so many people saying, if F.W. de Klerk releases Nelson Mandela, then he's not going to be the president anymore because the nasty vipers in his party are going to take him out and we're going to get something even worse. So also centrists were saying it's a crazy thing to do or a dangerous thing to do. And yet he did it, and it was the right thing to do. And no one congratulates him, and no one congratulates him for the simple reason that no one can consider anymore publicly out loud that F.W. de Klerk had the power. And F.W. de Klerk decided to let that power go in a beautiful and admirable and correct way after a nasty, nasty history. He came in as this country's greatest reformer.
Instead,
no one celebrates
that. What we have is that organization, which is the distilled essence of, as far as I'm concerned, evil in this country, the EFF, spitting in his face metaphorically and demanding that he be thrown out of parliament during the State of the Nation address.
They literally said the guy who released Mandela 30 years ago cannot sit in parliament today and listen to what the new president has to say.
P.W. Botha?
No respect.
Sure. I see where you're coming from.
P.W. Botha was – yeah,
but,
I agree.
But F.W. de Klerk? Nah, guys.
No, man, you've got to be serious. And it's.
But I mean, you know, speaking of serious, did you see the EFF this week saying that black people now can no longer fly to Durban because SAA has cancelled their flight there?
Oh my God! No, man, they're not serious.
It's not even the cheapest airline. But this is the problem with them. They work in a realm of just total fiction.
They do. I want to say one more thing about F.W. de Klerk. Since I've been knocking on Mandela, dude, I can't explain seriously enough how open criticism of a hero and a champion is not a way of taking them off their pedestal. It's a way of putting them on a real pedestal. And there are real pedestals.
Despite their flaws, they were actually this great thing.
Exactly. True human greatness does not lie in perfection.
Yeah, I think my favorite example of that is Churchill, right? Yeah. He had this moment of extreme sort of moral courage where he says, we are not going to negotiate with the Nazis. We are going to push on through. And yet you can see his whole career. It has so many sort of black spots in it. You know, the kind of lack of attention to stuff going on in India.
He was really bad on India. Yeah.
His Gallipoli campaign, which was probably a good idea, but ended up in a massive disaster.
Yeah.
There were so many things like this where he was sort of a little bit out of control.
Yeah.
And yet, he's still a great man and a great human being because he did exactly what was needed of him at the moment of crisis.
Perfect. And the same can be said of Mandela, especially 1992 through 1999. Of F.W. de Klerk, I just want to give a word of warning. To celebrate F.W. de Klerk is the kind of thing – why do you think South Africans struggle to do it so much? Let me tell you why I think South Africans struggle to do it so much. Besides the Nelson Mandela thing. And maybe this is a thing for white South Africans in particular. I think a lot of people in this country, because this country is so race obsessed and has been so defined by race for a long time, I think people think of race as an esteem team. So if you celebrate someone within the race, and especially if it's in the realm of politics, and especially if it's in the realm of race politics, if someone does a good thing, then somehow that's good for everyone of the same race. This is the esteemed team idea. If the guy playing soccer for the team you support scores a goal, it makes you feel good about yourself. Somehow it makes you and all the fan club cool as well.
The EFF likes to talk about black excellence.
Yeah. So
while undermining it at the same time.
Yeah. So, well, if some black dude like Julius Malema has a Gucci watch, then somehow that's good for all black people. That's their thought, right? That's their thought.
That is their idea. Yes.
And some people do think that way. That's certainly how the Nazis thought. They thought, you know, if the Führer is great, it's kind of somehow he's like playing – he's on the soccer field representing all Germans. So it's the wrong way to think. To celebrate and admire F.W. de Klerk is not to admire whiteness. It's not to give good points to whiteness. Only fools think that. If you happen to be listening to this and you are not white or you are white, you have equal access to the basic humanity that made de Klerk see that the only way forward was to release Mandela and to negotiate with him a peaceful liberal constitution. That humanity cuts way through. There is an esteem team that you can buy into, and it's humanity. It is a great exercise in humanity. It's something all humans can be proud of.
It's a team like that stepping should be much bigger than it is.
Yeah, dude, it's the littlest team in this country, but it's the most important team that there is. It's the same, you know. It's like the poets. When a poet does really well, it's because they're striking through the bullshit and they're hitting humanity. And that's why we can all get the good poets or the good musicians games designers.
Old Bill Shakespeare is so universally recognized.
Yeah, especially by the co-founder of the ANC, Saul Plaike, for example, biggest fan. Because he also got it. He got it. Anyway, so the point is, in celebrating F.W. de Klerk this week on a personal level, and I did. I went to quiz on Tuesday night and I said to everyone, cheers to F.W. de Klerk. And the sort of that faction of the quiz that teaches that are professors at some of our local universities gave me the biggest stink eye that I've gotten in years.
Well, that's what university does to you. Avoid university if you can, kids.
It has nothing to do with some white team. God, there is such a thing as a white team, and it's the enemy.
Yes.
There is such a thing as a black team. That's the enemy. The real good teams.
Those people are what we like to call racists.
Yes. It's like really straightforward. Celebrating good dudes, whether it's like the authors of the Bhagavad Gita or Herodotus or...
I have not read the Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah, you know, it's a great text. I've read a little bit of it and I think there's some profound transcendental wisdom in there.
Well, that's probably why it founded a religion that's lasted for 4,000 years.
Yeah, and you know what? Ain't got nothing to do with race. Also, those Russian writers who did very good things, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy... You can read them from anywhere. You don't have to be a Slav to like Russian literature. Anyone who thinks you have to be a Slav to like Russian literature is like just automatically disqualifying themselves from being taken seriously. But somehow to think that you can only be a fan of F.W. de Klerk if you look a certain way, that's like a serious idea. And I'm just debunking that idea. Say that's bullshit. It's a nice week to remember F.W. de Klerk. He did a bloody good thing 30 years ago. Nelson Mandela responded to it beautifully. He made a mistake in his later years, I think, of allowing people to celebrate him for what he didn't deserve to be celebrated for, and that's some kind of military heroism. Instead, he should have said, guys, don't love me for what I ain't. Love me for what I am. And what I am is the greatest pragmatist in this country's history as president, maybe since much, maybe ever, and the most serious promulgator of profound human values. I am not the war hero that you make me out to be, and stop celebrating me on that purpose. If it means I get less likes, so be it. Let me get less likes. If Hindenburg had done that in 1920s Germany, we wouldn't be talking about him today, because there would have been no Hitler.
Well, Germany would have had a better shot, yes, for sure, of not being the dystopian hellhole that it found itself turning into in the 30s.
And it went the way that it did. And it hasn't gone that way yet, and it can't go that way. We're just not organized enough. But as we
but it can still be plenty bad.
The trains can't be on time here, but it can still be plenty bad. And so since everything is going slower, I'm just putting my head above the parapet to say, if Mandela had the chance and had had the space for an honest conversation about it, I think he would say, you know, it is a mistake for the youth to think that we were cheated at the negotiating table. Mm. They're underestimating how well I negotiated, because I negotiated damn well. in fact, I negotiated the deal of the century, given how weak our military forces were.
The deal of the century, believe me.
So here we are speaking as Mandela in Trump's voice.
What else?
This will. I'm trying to mix the two accents in my head.
That's a crime against God.
And a really,
I'll try that once.
It's a really short circuit in my brain.
So what else? What else should we talk about? What have we had? We've had the American Democrats having their primary in New Hampshire, and we've had the State of the Nation in South Africa.
Dude, tell me that thing. Nate Silver is the greatest pollster in the history of the world.
I don't know about that, but he's definitely a clever lad.
And what's his take on Florida?
His take was that emoji where the little person is shrugging.
Because
he doesn't seem to like their model has changed so violently as each thing has happened. Nothing has worked out.
Polling science has been broken.
It appears to have been broken. Now, to be fair, the polling for the Iowa caucuses was way off, but that's because caucuses, because they're a very weird thing that we don't need to get into too much.
Yeah,
are very difficult to poll.
Yeah, the real margin of error.
If anyone is telling you who's going to win the Nevada caucus, which is coming up on I think Tuesday, they're wrong because it's completely impossible.
Because they don't know, and that's what Nate Silver and the clever guys were saying before New Hampshire. So it's not totally broken, but it is. Bloomberg is.
Yeah, even New Hampshire, they didn't see the massive surge coming for Amy Klobuchar at the end.
Yeah.
Bloomberg is polling well everywhere, but in some places Biden just seems to have this polling ability to resist the waves of change in the electorate. You know, Biden's done terribly in the first two contests. And yet, you know, a lot of his national polling hasn't changed that much.
Yeah.
Some of it's a bit down. Some of it's about the same place it was. And in a lot of states, he seems to still be in the same place.
Okay, but since we've been talking about Hitler, can I say my theory about why that is?
Yeah.
So George Orwell
– I haven't heard this, so it could be bad.
If this is me doing the Mandela Trump voice thing, stop me before I get there. Okay. So Orwell had this theory about – Orwell wrote a review of Mein Kampf in 1940 that is the single best page of journalism in the 20th century, according to one Gabriel Krauser. Shoot me if you think I'm wrong, but not with the real gun. And one of the things he says about – Mein Kampf in 1940s, he says, okay, in 1938, Mein Kampf was still the fashionable book. You'd see it in the manor houses of fancy gents. You'd lay it on the coffee table conspicuously next to the new telephonic device.
Something happened in 1939 that changed that somewhat.
Then all of a sudden it became so unfashionable that the Red Cross is advertised as getting all the proceeds from book sales.
My favorite American writer, Jonah Goldberg, likes to say that the words to some famous song was, "You're the best, you're Mussolini." It used to be very popular in America.
It was really hip in America until
suddenly in the 30s.
Very quickly not so popular. So the esteem economy can turn on a dime. It's such an important thing to remember in this racist country, because it can turn on a dime. Our true values can shine through in just a moment. It's happened before. Things change quickly.
Zuma went from the hero of the people to the agent of state capture in about 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah, and not the first two, by the way. The last two, just so that you know, if you haven't been following closely. Okay, so Orwell says, now that we all hate Hitler, thank God, I'd like to get to a very important point. Why does anyone love him? Because when all of a sudden everyone wants to hate him, then that's the nice time for the contrarian to say –
They all get very confused as to why do people love him.
Yes, let's not forget why they love him. And he identifies a few points. One of them is that pain – one of them is that, like, he says capitalism is offering pain in 5 minutes. Pleasure.
I'm interested to see how you're going to connect this to Biden.
I'll get there. He's saying capitalism offers pleasure in 5 minutes. Socialism offers pleasure in 5 years. But fascism offers pain. And people are attracted to pain. People want their meaning to have suffering, and their suffering to have meaning. The Ballantines might have just gone to my head, I say, as Nicholas is taking a picture of his own Ballantines. one attraction of fascism more generally is it gives meaning to suffering, and that's something that people want, especially when they're full of suffering, and they don't really trust pleasure anymore. They find pleasure in pain. They find masochism and sadism. They find sadomasochism. And that's the great insight of understanding the appeal of fascism as a whole. But he says if you understand the appeal of Hitler, who can't really write very well, it's very verbose, it's sort of poor sentence structure a lot of the time, quite hard to read. I know because I've tried to read Mein Kampf a few times myself. The great attraction of Hitler, Orwell says, is you can see it all in his face in the picture that used to be on the back of the book before the Red Cross donations were on the back of the book, when it used to be fashionable just to have his face.
Ooh.
It's grisly, dude. Ooh. It's grisly. And what was his face? He said, Orwell said, his face, his is the face of a man that aims and strives to succeed, but you know for all the world he will fail. He is a man doomed to failure, but who nevertheless tries. He's a striver.
Wait. Are you trying to claim that people like Biden because he looks like he's destined to fail?
I think that they like him in the same kind of way. Part of the esteem economy's basic function is that a lot of people just want to like a winner. They like winning itself. And so whatever looks like winning, they'll like that.
So you think that his attraction is that he is the noble loser?
I think that there's part of the – in every society, just as there's like 10% gays, 10% dudes who like Warcraft, there's like
– Represent.
There's 10% dudes being a bi-gender term, just by the way, who really like the look of someone who's going to try, whether they win or lose, because they're in it for something
deeper.
Well,
that deeper. Used to be what defined the line.
That's Biden. Fan. That's Hitler. That's the Lions rugby fan. That was Tottenham Hotspurs fans until they did really well. That was Springbok fans sort of after Jake White but before Rassie Erasmus.
Do Bafana fans count? Because they don't really ever win.
If you are a Bafana fan, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Bafana won the African Cup of Nations in 1998 or thereabouts and hasn't won a soccer match since, that I've noticed. And yet they're dudes who wear Bafana jerseys, including myself sometimes, and watch their matches, including myself sometimes, and they're not in it to win it. They're just in it. And that's Biden fans. Dude, most Biden fans really – winning is cool. Losing proves that the system is rigged, which is the basis of the reason that we're doing this in the first place.
I don't know. That sounds a lot like Sanders fans from the first time around.
You think they're different this time?
Yeah, I think that they're the people who are looking at this thing and they're like – I don't know about these other people. They all look a bit too clever or a bit too fancy or a bit too radical. I think we're just going to go with this guy because he's like, you know, we know him. He's been around. He's our dude. And I think that's particularly why black Americans have seemed to be the biggest support block for him, because they look at him and they say
– Really? Are they not still with Biden?
No, I'm talking with Biden.
Oh, you were saying Sanders.
Yeah. No, I'm saying in the first time was Sanders, and this is – I'm describing
– And now Biden. So Biden's fans –
He's what you know.
Biden's fans are exactly what you know. It's what Americans call like apple pie.
Meal, yeah.
Yes. For me, boiled chicken.
And Sanders' time is the sort
but
of –
But I'm saying Sanders are the guys who are are the losers. They – And not losers in a derogatory way. Like, I've got a lot of respect for people who don't care about winning or losing.
Dude, I come from a political family that's been in opposition politics since forever, like six decades.
Literally for generations.
We're used to losing, so I know the feeling very well.
That noble loser thing. So I'm not surprised that some candidates are quite resistant to this early bump in favor of Buttigieg and Klobuchar's comeback and Bloomberg's massive money kind of swing in, because they don't really mind one way or another. For a lot of Biden fans, it is, as you say, it's mother's own cooking, and that's something that you're going to like, whatever's winning the fashion stakes. And for Sanders fans, it's this ultra revolutionary.
We're in the revolution.
They're both dedicated to losing. Mm-hmm. And I think – and I really do think that in itself is neither good nor bad. I think being a dedicated loser is neither good nor bad. It's like a gun or a knife. It can go either way.
So the Bernie fans on Twitter are the worst of the Twitter fans. Now, all the Twitter fans are bad.
Yeah.
But the Bernie ones are the worst. I think a whole bunch of the Bernie ones, like the Culinary Union is very powerful in Nevada Democratic politics. Right, and the fact that they didn't endorse Bernie Sanders, or that they were suspected of being about to endorse one of the other candidates, got, I think all of the union brass had their personal details leaked, and were sent thousands of death threats by these chaps. And Bernie Sanders, it's gotten so
that's
bad
not nice,
that he had to say
that's serious.
He had to say, no, stop being mean. Don't be a thug. That kind
stop
of
being a thug.
This isn't what our revolution is about.
That's very Brooklyn. Your Brooklyn is sort of going to Queens.
Yeah, I haven't spent as long in New York as you have.
We really need to work on our accents. I think it's secretly one of our key assets on this podcast. It's kind of two crickets. It's kind of two dudes trying to do accents.
That's the only reason anyone listens. By the way, thank you to everyone for listening, because this is, I think, last week was our most downloaded episode ever.
Yeah.
So thank you very much.
No, it's really growing nicely. It's been growing consistently over the last year. And for regular fans from the beginning, you would have heard a little bit of what I said at the start already. But I'm happy to – I hope you're happy to hear it again and hear us flesh it out a little bit more. We're pulling up to 10 minutes before the end. We've done South African politics.
Let's just talk
American
about
politics,
and I'll summarize it as this, which is that it was the most Cyril speech ever. It can't stand against its own contradictions, and I'm so glad that I wasn't forced to watch it. I just could watch the updates and text on the side while I played video games.
I hate you.
Ah, the power just flickered, and yet our recording remains alive.
Oh my God. We have lost an episode of Two Crickets
because of that.
But the generator kicked in just in time. So hopefully this is going to work. Nick,
we need to end quickly before something goes wrong.
No, we need to quickly pour ourselves another Ballantine's.
No, dude, I don't know if I can. Dude, I don't know if I can handle another whiskey.
I don't want to talk about Sona, because the thing about Sona, it started with this like EFF thing, which was a distraction from Sona, and Sona was a distraction from the real issues.
Yes.
So there was a distraction within a distraction, which
is confirmed that someone in the ANC, maybe it's the ACE faction, maybe it's even Cyril himself, is using the EFF like a beautiful tool to just hide their nonsense and to create this fake dynamic. I mean, people like my great nemesis, Adrian Basson, I don't know why, he's ended up becoming the face of everything I complain about in the media. But
well, he's probably a really important, powerful guy.
It's also probably because I visit News 24 more than other news websites.
Yeah.
That's not an endorsement.
You hate read News 24.
No, I'm just lazy because it's the one I have bookmarked. And the others are even worse.
I read it a lot because it's important. Yeah.
Anyway, Adrian Basson has completely fallen for this sort of little narrative play that's being played out. Ooh, is the state capture Zoomerites against the noble Cyril, and Cyril's battling them, and Pravin Gordhan and Cyril are fighting with the forces of darkness. Meanwhile, both factions are doing their level best to put us absolutely in the lurch.
Yeah.
I mean, Cyril on one hand stands up and says, well, we're endorsing Tito Mboweni's economic plan. What a great idea. I'm so happy he did that.
Yeah, no, it really is good that he did that.
And then at the same time, he says, by the way, we're expropriating the land and I'm looking forward to amending the constitution. Then he says, we have great problems in this country and I'm very concerned about them. And it's like, yes, that's brilliant.
Yes.
Thank you for saying that.
Yes, you and started so seriously.
At the same time, he's like, but also our education system is great and congratulations to everyone who passed matric, even though we've got huge numbers of kids who can't even...
Dude, he cites the bullshit like 86% matric pass rate, which is only true if you don't count all of the dudes who dropped out in grade 11, which is like 30% of the dudes.
And you don't count the number of people who got below 50% for their subjects and yet still pass. He also has all this nice rhetoric about uniting people and bringing unity in the country and building a South Africa for both black and white. And then he goes on to talk about how NHI and how we're so looking forward to it, something that will destroy the middle class in this country, both black and white. So I suppose he's doing something for both black and white. Unify us through suffering.
Oh, my God. Okay, Nick, cheers to unification through suffering.
Sorry, I'm pessimistic.
That was our Sona special. I had to read the whole goddamn thing and speak about it with various other sort of TV platforms.
I read it.
So No, I know you did.
Read it as closely as yet.
No, you read it the next day, like I read it the next day. Watching it at night, I couldn't bring myself to do. That's it. We've got another. We've managed to do that in 4 minutes. I don't want to talk about Sona anymore.
Yeah, I know it's rubbish. Okay, we'll talk about the whole day.
So 6-minute special.
And I guess the conclusion for the soda thing is this.
No.
Which is that
No, I don't want to hear this. No more soda.
You'll like this. Give me a chance.
Ow.
No, we're not allowed to give financial advice, but I'm buying gold.
Dude, you really need to buy gold. Okay, cheers to buying gold.
Cheers to buying gold.
And now for our final 5-minute special, where Nicholas is going to tell us about pyramids.
So this, I think, is something we're going to have to explore in another podcast, but this is a great idea. The pyramids at the time, probably, unless you were, of course, a religious-believing Egyptian, probably seemed like a really, really sick idea. You were going to get the entire workforce in their off-season to, instead of doing whatever they could do, you know, maybe make stuff, maybe invent things, maybe just relax.
Hmm.
You were going to force them to drag very heavy blocks of stone up a very big dirt ramp and pile them on top of each other so that you could put all of your valuables inside.
And then put a dead dude inside.
Put a dead dude with the valuables.
Then limestone it.
Then limestone the whole thing.
And just leave it.
What if you propose this in a modern economy? People, even Bernie Sanders, would be like, this is wasteful expenditure. I don't know why we're doing this.
This is big government gone wild.
Right?
This is not even for the 1%. They're taking all the money, they're putting it inside a triangle of rocks. You can't, then they close the door.
I don't care how many jobs it's creating, it's not worth it.
But in South Africa, but the thing is,
you know what?
At least you would see it.
And here's the thing. 2,000 years after the pyramids built, 3,000 years after the pyramids built,
yeah,
the Romans and the Greeks are visiting them as a tourist attraction.
Isn't that amazing?
The whole Egyptian tourist industry is based off of these massive piles of stone in the
desert. That's the Egyptian tourist industry 2,500 years ago from us.
Yes, from us. It's still going today.
It's the world's greatest tourist. It's the best investment.
It was an amazing idea. So here's the thing.
5,000. If you're thinking in a 10,000-year horizon, if Ramaphosa really is a long-term strategist,
if he really wants
guys,
to
we
make
need
work,
to get serious about the long-term
if
strategy.
If he wants to use government to create jobs, why not pile a really large number of bricks on top of each other?
Go long-term, guys. Go really long-term.
If you make a really cool building,
yeah,
even one that's useless, people will come and view it.
Dude, if you make that pile big enough, in 7,000 years' time,
people will
the long-term strategy will pay off.
Just make it out of something really durable. Put some impressive structure to it. Maybe add a little bit of mystery so that people will claim that it was built by aliens or something stupid.
Yeah, exactly.
In 5,000 years.
Put gold inside.
And or you don't even have to. You just have to tell people you put gold inside.
Tell people you put gold inside, but buy gold. Keep it. Buy gold and keep it. But put the gold inside.
Although we're not licensed financially.
We're not telling you that. We're just saying buy gold.
Yeah, we're just saying buy
gold. It's like a song. It's just a lyric from a song, buy gold.
But monumentalism is a massively underutilized concept in the modern world because we've gotten all so practical.
Yeah.
And actually, it can be a damn good idea in very specific circumstances, like when you have an enormous amount of unemployment. And also, it probably wouldn't cost as much as how much money the government throws away on a lot of other things.
Yeah. So if the government like privatized,
we privatize SA and Eskom, and we can use the savings to build a pyramid.
Yeah, dude, I reckon we could build like a pyramid and a half. Dude, it's gonna be so lit, fam. Woke.
And I think
it will outlive the words lit fam and work. It will probably outlive the English language.
It actually will. And I think on that high note,
okay,
we probably have to call this to an end,
guys,
before we come up with another bad idea.
Guys, if you have had a week as long as ours, battling, have a really good weekend. We will be back with you next Friday. And keep free, keep loving freedom, keep thinking.